Our reading is by Dr. Frank Rogers, Jr., and this is his story. James Worthington knows compassion. James runs an inner-city youth program that offers young people an alternative to the deceptive lures of gang life. He tells his kids about Raul Torres, a former custodian in their community. Raul lived with his wife of 45 years on a modest corner lot in South Central Los Angeles. When his wife died of a stroke in her sleep, Raul was grief-stricken. Raul decided to plant a memorial garden for his wife. It spanned the entire corner lot, and it contained rows of his beloved's favorite prize-worthy roses of a dozen different hues. One morning, Raul discovered that several rose bushes had been demolished. Shreds of blossom and bush were strewn on the ground as if they had been assaulted with a baseball bat. Afraid of doing anything else, Raul simply swept up the mess, repaired the bushes, and tended the garden as if nothing had happened. 2 days later, another bush was attacked. A few days later, yet another one. Angry and afraid, heartsick and powerless, Raul was beside himself about what to do. That is when Raul saw the boy. The 10-year-old lived alone with his mother. His father had been gone for years, and his brother, a gang member, was in jail for killing a rival. In retaliation for the murder his brother committed, a drive-by occurred at the boy's home. His leg was nicked by a bullet. Though scarcely limping any longer, the boy still walked with a cane. And when he got to the roses, the boy wielded the cane like a weapon and lashed out at one of the roses. Raul's first instinct was to chase the boy down and scold him. But he could not shake those eyes. It was as if Raul could see it all. The boy's aloneness, the rage, the terror, the futility, and lacing throughout the despair that would make a future in gang life all but inevitable. That afternoon, Raul found the boy walking home from school and approached him. The boy hardened in defiance. Raul told him he was having trouble with his garden. Someone was destroying his flowers. He needed someone to help him protect the flowers and to help him care for them from time to time. He'd pay him, he'd let him plant his own bushes, and he'd teach him how to grow plants if the boy wanted. The boy was skeptical. Raul offered that they try it for 1 week. On Saturday, the boy showed up. He stayed the better part of the day. Raul taught him how to tend roses and helped him plant a rose bush of his own. They harvested tomatoes and cut fresh herbs, and at day's end, they picked a bag full of lemons and made fresh lemonade. It was so good, the boy came back the following week and the next. To this day, James asserts, the garden has never been vandalized again. He would know. He's the boy who bludgeoned the roses. And this neighborhood is still his turf. It's where he works with other young people, offering them a place to flourish in the midst of the ever-present violence. When discussing compassion, we must be aware of the painful reality of our planet. We live in a violent world, and yet, in the midst of the world's brutality, a retired custodian named Raul shines as a beacon of compassion. His example shows us that in the midst of the violence around and within us, it is possible to recover and retain our humanity. However mundane or severe the conflicts or afflictions that burden us, a path toward life and reconnection lies before us. The path is radical, but so is its promise. It uncovers genuine compassion, a compassion so healing, it resuscitates the heart of a man stricken by grief, and it softens the heart of a boy hardened into despairing rage.
As some of you may know, I've begun a journey these past months to obtain a doctoral degree in the practical arts of ministry. And so I spent some time in Oregon this January at Claremont School of Theology's new headquarters at Willamette University. While there, I opted to stay in the dorm room that was being offered as a nearby walking option from class. Not knowing whether I'd be driving in ice or snow, I thought, how bad can a dorm room be? Anyway, my question was answered by the 4-inch mattress and the sheets that have been washed so many times you could see through them, plus the bathroom that was out in the hall and down the corner, and I'm basically in the next county. So I discovered that we get set in our ways with time, right? And that's really what I want to share with you this morning from my time in Oregon, a practice that helps us to get unset in our ways. A practice that helps bring us back to compassion when compassion is hard to find. So Dr. Frank Rogers Jr., who we've been hearing from this morning, he doesn't demand attention when he enters the room. He's more inclined to speak in awe about your successes than he is to talk about his successful books or his PhD from Princeton or his founding of the Center for Engaged Compassion. Their mission statement, by the way, that Center for Engaged Compassion, is that they are seeking to repair the world by applying the ancient wisdom of compassion and contemplative practices to the problems of today. The wisdom traditions of the world teach that this kind of compassion, a compassion that arises from a truly engaged sensibility, is necessary for creating true peace, reconciliation, and healing within secular as well as religious contexts. The Center's social transformation projects integrate the knowledge and formative practices of the world's wisdom traditions with the most advanced contemporary understandings of the human arts and sciences. Sounds thoroughly UU in every way, both in intention and methodology. But first of all, what are we even talking about when we talk about compassion? So one of the points Dr. Rogers makes is that empathy and compassion are often conflated, mistakenly. Empathy is when we put ourselves in another's shoes. We allow ourselves to feel what they must be feeling. We've all done that. We all have that capacity for empathy, and we know sometimes it's really hard. It's hard to put ourselves in the shoes of someone who might be going through chemotherapy, might be recovering from domestic violence, someone dealing with the death of a loved one. We can sit with that person and feel, to some degree anyway, what they are feeling. And then we often come home and feel wiped out from that process. I hear people talk about the burnout that comes from empathy. And even to me, they'll say, how can you do that? When I talk about facilitating our own grief group here at UUCF or meeting with a congregant going through a life crisis, I hear people talk about people who work in hospices or some of you who are nurses or in trauma units or therapists, teachers, counselors. How can they do that? The idea is that being with people in crisis and practicing empathy is exhausting. And the truth is, they're right. If we're only practicing empathy, it is exhausting. And this is evidenced by several brain studies Dr. Rogers talked about. Empathy and empathy alone is not enough to sustain us. So how does compassion differ? Rogers defines compassion as a genuine, loving regard that flows freely from the heart. So what this means is that to achieve compassion, we don't just empathize with someone else's feelings, their anger, their frustration, sadness, despair, pain. We then position ourselves with a loving regard for them. So unlike empathy, in scientific studies, this practice of compassion actually ignites different areas in our brain than empathy does. And it's not the areas that exhaust us, but rather the ones that restore and nurture us. Compassion actually leads us back to our own humanity. It doesn't drain us like unfettered empathy does. It actually gives back. So I'm convinced that people who are truly successful in the helping professions, again, teachers, doctors, nurses, social activists, etc., all at least instinctively have somewhere along the way stumbled upon the practice of not just being empathetic, but actually taking that next step of lovingly regarding those they are empathizing with. This active engagement with love is what continues to feed them. Dr. Rogers says our compassionate, connective self is our truest self. This is actually our essence, our core. Cultivating compassion is about remembering who we really are, removing the obstacles that get in the way to uncover our truest essence. But of course, this is really easy to talk about and so much more difficult to practice when we are triggered by difficult situations and difficult people. And I know none of us ever have those in our lives, right? But what happens when we find ourselves in a place with those difficult people, those difficult situations? We move from our connected self to our opposite self, our alienated self. And when we're in this place, we are enslaved by what Dr. Rogers calls our interior movements. Now, these are overwhelming emotions, those internal monologues that tell us we're not good enough, habitual behaviors that aren't good for us, narratives that are negative, real and imagined, that replay through our heads. And then there's all the bodily sensations that go with this: tension headaches, upset stomachs, stiff necks, etc. When we're in this state, we often respond in one of two ways. We either act out, which means we submit to these feelings, or we resist. We try to ignore what's happening inside of us. So needless to say, both acting out and resisting are counterproductive. Neither one addresses that these activated interior movements are rooted in internal suffering. What Rogers sees as distorted cries frantically waving to get our attention. So what's going on inside of us when we're triggered by something is that there's these fears that we're still holding on to waving at us, or deep longing saying, hey, I'm over here. There's these aching wounds that still need to be healed. There's gifts that have been stifled that are trying to make themselves noticed to us. These interior movements aren't bad things. They're actually flags intended to secure our survival, our healing, our flourishing even. We just have to know how to respond to them. So that's one of the reasons that Frank Rogers set out to create an intentional practice to help us reconnect with compassion for ourselves and others, especially when it's hard. So he capsulizes the process of restoring compassion using the acronym PULSE, PULSE. We're taking our pulse, so to speak. So what does PULSE mean? PULSE stands for paying attention to the movement, what's going on inside of us, without acting out its power, nor even judging its presence within us. So if you think about something that triggers you, and we've all got them, maybe it's somebody in your life, hopefully not somebody you have to see every day, right? But might be. Maybe it's a particular issue or a person in the news that gets your heart pounding up in your ears. Maybe it's a situation in your job or your family that always ends in raised voices. Whatever it is, we know it's hard to pay attention to what's actually happening within us during those moments. When we're being reactive or we're resisting, we aren't able to simply pay attention and ask ourselves, what am I feeling? What am I noticing in this moment? By paying attention, we actually free ourselves from being enslaved to these interior movements. The U then in PULSE refers to understanding the suffering at the root of that movement's cry. What's really going on in this moment? What am I really feeling? What other situations in my life does this feel like? So I'll give you one instance from my own life that happened just this week. So I woke up pretty early on Monday because that's my day off, right? So naturally I wake up at 5:30 on my day off. And I decided to check my email. So I found I had received an email from the dean at my seminary that was entitled, "Concerned About Your Coursework." So this is never a good thing, right? 5:30 in the morning. So the lengthy email was clearly written with a great deal of concern. It was informing me I currently had a C in one of my classes, and a C was considered failing at the doctoral level. Well, I knew immediately this was a mistake. I had received full credit for everything I'd done in that class, including 100% on the only paper we had turned in thus far. But even though I knew, Intellectually, I knew some mistake had been made. I found myself quite reactive. How dare they send me this email? What will people think of me? Don't they know what a good student I am? I haven't even paid for the rest of the semester. Maybe I won't now. And so on. And I was equal parts reactive and resisting, as the other part of me kept telling myself, oh, don't be an idiot. You know this is a simple mistake, easily correctable. Why are you making such a big deal about this? Why is it bringing up all these feelings for you? So I finally settled down into moving through the compassion practice. And the first thing I did was take a breath and catalog all I was feeling. And in so doing, I was able to step away from being enslaved by those interior movements and actually feel a certain objectivity about them. Meanwhile, Lawrence is just snoring away next to me, and I wanted to just wake him up. So the second step is about understanding the suffering at the root. So I asked myself, what is this about? Really, what is this about? And it was an easy connection to make. I'm a good student. I always have been. And it's not hard for me to understand why. As a young boy, I was more inclined to read books than play sports. So I was wasn't like a lot of the other boys. And being good in school helped me to feel like I had some kind of value. It made me feel worthy of being alive, of having a place on this earth. So an email like this threatened my very sense of value, my sense of being worthy of being here. Now, this is heavy stuff at about, this is like 5:55 at this point in the morning, you know. So what happens next in the pulse practice? We get to the L. And L is for loving with empathetic connection the suffering that we have identified here. And this is the place where I think most of us probably intuitively don't get to. We maybe can kind of recognize sometimes where the problem is coming from, but then we don't know what to do at that point. It's like, well, I understand this is an old story and all that, but I'm still angry. So I had to actually, and this sounds funny because it's not anything you can really do concretely, but empathetically reach out and love that kid, that boy who thought his self-worth was tied up with how good a student he was. And not have any judgment or shame about him and those feelings, but just love him. And of course, that's me. So the S of pulse, this is where I may lose some of you, but I hope not. So try and stay with me. Rogers describes S as sensing the sacred's compassion for whatever that suffering is. So we've moved to loving ourselves for this old wound or whatever it is, and now we're actually looking to sense the sacred. Now, I know there's a certain number in this room who don't believe in a particular conception of God, and there's a certain number who do. And so what are we talking about so that we can have a shared understanding of this in this room when we talk about the sacred here? Well, I think a way of understanding this is by thinking about what is universal about the experience and then bestowing compassion upon it in recognition of it as a part of the larger human experience. So when I pull myself back from myself in this situation I'm talking about, I can recognize that, of course, I was only one of many children who felt like, for whatever reason, they didn't belong. And I was only one of many children who found something that adults approved of and made that a way of valuing myself. And whether it's a little girl who thought she always had to be pretty to be of value, or whatever it is, a kid who, you know, has to hit the ball a certain way, whatever it is, I'm not alone in that. And I can feel there is a universal sense of compassion available to us all. Call it the sacred, or God, or the divine, or simply common sense in understanding that this is part of the human experience. Whatever we call it, I can feel this sense of care when I pull back from my individual self to something that has larger scope. Okay? And finally, we get to the E of pulse. We're taking our pulse here, right? Embodying the new life aching to be birthed. This is where we ask ourselves, what have we learned from this? Who am I now that I have extended this compassion to myself and allowed that sense of greater compassion available to all of us? I've allowed that in. Roger says this step allows us to now extend compassion toward others. So in the example I shared, by the time my professor had sent an email explaining that she had lost my paper in the shuffle of her emails, I was able to send back a response saying, "Don't worry, it could happen to anyone, it's no big deal." And that's probably the response I would have sent before, but this time I actually meant it, right? What had been annoyance and frustration and maybe anger even had changed to compassion through moving through this process. So the example I gave was from a reasonably difficult situation, but what if there had been a difficult person involved? I was working with reasonable people here, right? So the process is the same initially. We go through the pulse process, taking our own pulse, finding compassion for ourselves first. We always have to start with ourselves. And then we go through the pulse process again, but this time we focus it on the other person. We non-judgmentally pay attention to their behaviors, emotions, words, body language. We then seek to understand them. What seems to be their deepest fear, their deepest longing, their old wound, their stifled gift that's just waiting to be recognized. And I'll tell you, we can't have definitive answers a lot of the time for these things. It's more like we're detectives. We have to work from our intellects, our instinct, our imagination, the clues we get. But that's all okay, because for those of you who are professional therapists and psychologists in this room, we're not actually trying to diagnose anybody. We are simply trying to find some way of conceptualizing our own sense of their humanity. So we're using the clues that we receive from them in order to kind of fill in the gaps and be able to reconnect our sense of compassion toward them. Then, of course, we invite in the love for what that understanding has revealed about that person. We work to sense what is sacred or universal about this. And then finally, we embody all of this in ourselves as we consider what our next steps are with that person. So it's a valuable process. I encourage you to read more about it, to think about it, and consider how an intentional process might be helpful in your own life. And I also think it matters to we liberally religious folks who call ourselves Unitarian Universalists. Part of our call, one that stems from our Protestant roots, from our secular humanist roots, is to help humanity be the best it can be. In the times we live in, it can be challenging, to say the least, to maintain our compassion both for ourselves and others. Compassion brings us closer to who we truly are at our core. We're talking about being in touch with our best selves, our connected selves. And I think this world desperately needs that right now. We're not going to heal from our recent past by simply voting in new leadership, even though that's important, or building new systems, even though that's important. We have to begin to intentionally work to be the compassionate species humanity can be. And when we can do so, we teach our children to be the same, and they in turn will teach their children, and perhaps someday, long after we're gone, but our legacy remains nonetheless, this world will begin to look more like the beloved community we know it can be. This is compassion, and this is our call.